Park Place Meeting, Saturday morning, 24th May, 1975.
It is well for our own sakes, as well as out of courtesy to those who have so kindly shown their interest as to join us for the first time this morning, to remind ourselves of certain basic points. We are concerned with religion, and the context of religion is transcendence. It embraces all existence, because transcendence, or if you like to use the word God or Brahman or whichever you please, permeates everything. This whole universe moves and lives purposively, non-compulsive purpose. Nevertheless, there is this purpose at work. And where we who are human beings are concerned, this purpose can be essentially summarized as the coming to fruition of the religiousness which lies deep in our nature. It is this religiousness within us which preeminently distinguishes us from all other creatures. Now, this religiousness is that element which is the most intimate point of contact with transcendence, with God. If this religiousness does not come to fruition, then through us, the sweet purposes of the divine energy have not found full expression. Now, there are certain very simple points in connection with allowing this religiousness within us to come to fulfillment. It is concerned, religiousness is concerned with the art of living life as religious beings. And the first thing we should bear in mind is that the religious life must not be separated from the secular life. If the secular life, as we commonly call it, does not have the spirit of religion animating it, the beauty of secularity itself never comes to fruition. It is spoiled. It is distorted. Or at best, it lacks that which is the crowning stone of the whole arch of our individual existence. This we must bear in mind. Therefore, it is unwise to separate religion from ordinary life. ordinary life has to be religious if it is to express our true humanity. It is easy enough to see that the important aspects of our secular life, like art, science, philosophy, the ordinary activities of daily living, commerce, and all the rest of it, they all have their separate respective spheres. But they all come within the ambit of worldliness. And anyone can see that where living in the world as a worldly being is concerned, one is animated primarily by self-concern, the limited, isolative self-concern. But if religion comes into play, then all these aspects of the worldly life become a unified whole, they become integrated, and they become transformed into something quite over and above all worldliness and all secularity. This is where the aspect of religion comes in. And in order that this may come in, each individual being has to express himself through his daily life in certain simple but very difficult to fulfill ways. First and foremost, there is the indispensability of purification, constant purification, the moralities we may call them, the observance of the commandments, if you like to put it that way, the virtues, they have to be there. And then there is that discipline of the mind and the heart by which one awakes to the reality of things, to the true nature of all life and of the purpose of our lives. As far as human beings are concerned, perhaps one of the noblest expressions of that purpose is in terms of such living that oneself is the living vehicle through which transcendence manifests itself. And therefore, this purification of the mind and the heart becomes associated with and is concerned with that change of our mode of awareness of daily existence, which changes it from the self-oriented into the unself-conscious state, so that we don't live unto ourselves, but, to use a well-known common phrase, for the glory of God. And here, of course, many elements come in. There are the early stages in which one observes certain religious observances as such. You'll find them in all the great religions of the world, and we'll touch upon one or two a little later. But first, with respect to the moralities. The world as a whole thinks of morality in very restricted terms. So long as you do the right thing, as laid down, you live in conformity with what is laid down, you are doing your duty, and it ends there for most people. But this is obviously a mistaken outlook, an altogether mistaken outlook. Because whatsoever we do is the result of so many other factors. Our inward desire, our urges, our whims and appetites and passions and all the rest of it, they are all driving forces inside us. And as a result of these, or in association with these, there is the whole intellectual thinking process, which plans to fulfill desire. Desire which is self-directed, remember, to give oneself pleasure above all, which is perhaps man's greatest illness, this wild pursuit of the pleasure drive. In various forms, it comes in subtle forms, in the name of refinement, of culture, of art, of beauty, of expressing one's personality, as we call it, upholding an image. And in the upholding of the image, the real living man within is submerged. It is the image which remains, a lifeless, dead thing. And it is a false image because it is born of the misperceptions of what we really are. So there is that pleasure drive to deal with. There are various other drives which we need not mention in detail. You all know them actually. So we come to the important point involved in this, that the moralities have to be fulfilled not merely in terms of outward action, but in terms of behavior, of speech, of feeling, and of thought. Let us, for example, take what has been presented first in point of time in the Upanishads. In the Shandilya Upanishad of the Hindus, for instance, you find the great teacher Atharvana teaching his disciple Shandilya that the moralities have to be observed in thought and speech and action. Every one of them. Later on, you find the same type of teaching reiterated by the Buddha. And later on again, you find Jesus speaking in the same way. Let me quote you something which Jesus himself said. Ye have heard that it hath been said, thou shalt love thy neighbor and hate thine enemy. But I say unto you, love your enemies bless them that curse you. Do good to them that hate you. And pray for them that despitefully use you and persecute you. And at the end of his life, and on behalf of those who crucified him, he prayed, Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. And again, speaking to his disciples after the Last Supper, he says, This is my commandment, that ye love one another as I have loved you. How does the Holy One love? Surely not in the ordinary worldly manner. The ordinary worldly manner is possessive. It is conditional, demanding something in return. It is based upon reciprocity merely. It isn't the transcendent reality of love. It is something which brings upheaval, sorrow, misery. But the Holy One loves differently. Why? How? The Holy One is no longer self-oriented. He is the living vehicle of transcendence itself. And that is the commandment which Jesus gives his disciples. As I have loved you, love ye one another. And what would be the consequences of this in daily life? The natural, spontaneous, inevitable consequences. What sort of courtesy, what sort of considerateness would we render to everyone around us? Would we act in such a way in any particular situation where we made ourselves troublesome to those around us? These are things to bear in mind. It is very easy to give way to our own impulses and our own desires, to impose ourselves upon our society. And imposing ourselves upon society means being noisy, not being silent, means being obtrusive, instead of being an integral part and parcel of the harmony of the whole of life. So easily we humans do this, don't we? So easily. And Jesus also said, Greater love hath no man than this, that a man lay down his life for his friends. 5 centuries before Jesus, the Buddha, speaking of the qualities of the friend who is the same in happiness and adversity and is sound of heart. And amongst the many things he says in that very remarkable discourse of his, he also says that the friend lays down even his life for your sake. in that famous parable of the saw, as it is called, the saw with which you cut wood. The Buddha instructs his monks that howsoever others act or speak to them or of them, gently or violently, the monks should train themselves thus. Neither will our minds become perverted, nor will we utter an evil speech, but kindly and compassionate will we dwell, with a mind of friendliness, void of hatred. And we will dwell having suffused that person, the person who hurts them or does wrong to them, with a mind of friendliness, and beginning with him, note carefully, beginning with him, we will dwell having suffused the whole world with a mind of friendliness like the whole of space, far-reaching, widespread, immeasurable, without enmity, without malevolence. We have only to be mindful in our daily life to note whether we live in this way or whether we fall short of this. Our annoyances, our impatiences, our angers, as they rise up. We live still at the animal level. I'm not insulting the animals, I trust. And a few moments later, in that same discourse, the Buddha says, monks, even if low-down thieves were to carve you limb from limb with a double-handled saw, yet even then, whoever, whether monk or nun, sets his mind at enmity, he or she, for this reason, is not a doer of my teaching. Herein you should train yourselves thus. Neither will our minds become perverted, and so on as before. But we shall dwell with a mind of friendliness pervading the whole world, far-reaching, widespread, immeasurable, without enmity, without malevolence. So you see, morality in the religious context has no restriction with regard to the perfection with which it should be fulfilled. It is a transcendent morality, a transcendent ethic. It is not a relative ethic. We in the world live in terms only of a relative ethic. Our ethic is conditional. If you do the right thing, if you are good, I will do the right thing by you and I will be good to you. If not, our ways will part. We might go further, you and I shall live separately. We shall cut ourselves off from each other. We shall descend to violence and hate and war and all the evils that the world knows of only too well. You see, man is man only when he can live by a transcendental ethic, not by a relative morality. Hence, to be truly a man and to live as a man, untainted by the impulses of the beast of prey within ourselves, is an extremely difficult task. At first, but understand the significance of transcendent morality. Understand it, see into it, be watchful, and in time it becomes second nature. Naturally and spontaneously one lives in that way. Now this is the fundamental basis of the religious life, the living of the good life, in thought, feeling, speech and action. One lives by the law of love par excellence. And he who lives by the law of love, because it necessitates, or rather I should say, naturally brings about freedom from self-orientedness, in any and every form, becomes wise. That means he sees the true nature of things and persons. He understands life. He understands what is the real, what is the truly worthwhile. And in that understanding, there is a release from within ourselves of the capacity, of the skill to live in accordance with that wisdom. You will see at once that wisdom has little relationship, very little relationship with acquired knowledge. Acquired knowledge is a possession. Why do we acquire knowledge? Consider. Why do we go to school? Why do we learn this? Why do we learn the other? In order to make a good living for ourselves. In order to promote our interests. And we human beings, such wonderfully clever people we are, that we have invented this diabolical phrase, enlightened self-interest, devilish goodness. It's extraordinary, isn't it? How right Puck was, Midsummer Night's Dream. Lord, what fools these mortals be. Now, let us consider another aspect, which I mentioned. The religious observances, the instruments of grace, as they are called in theistic religions in the world, those which are specifically theistic. And in these religious observances, you will find that all the religions, again, if you like, starting with the oldest and coming closer to our times, they mention worship, prayer. Now the world has seen innumerable forms of worship come into being. What is worship? The word is actually worthship. To hold worthy and to act in accordance with the worthiness that you see in that which you hold worthy. So we have in the theistic religions rather more marked, because God is personalized there, God as the supreme object of worship. You find it in Judaism to start with. You look at the names of God, which you find Elohim, for instance, El Shaddai, and so forth in the original Hebrew. And that means, the El part means the strong one, the mighty one, the capable one, and also it stands for the object of worship. That which is the supremely worthy. And to that one tenders one's homage. One gives one's whole self, absolute fidelity to the supreme that one can see and conceive of. Now this is something which we have to see for ourselves, from within ourselves, see and recognize and live by constantly. The masses of people in the world, because of what they are themselves, need some sort of ritualistic form in which to express this worship. But the unfortunate aspect is that the ritual, the outward shape, becomes paramount, and the inward reality, the inward animating spirit, gets lost. Those of us who are seriously concerned with the religious life, with living the holy life, have to concern ourselves with the spirit, essentially, rather than the external form. Now, in external worship, in going through a ceremonial system, in saying our prayers, as we call it. How do we say our prayers? We go through them at speed, don't we? But what exactly is a prayer? What exactly is the meaning of praying? It is the same in depth as being in constant meditation, continuous contemplation. The dialogue between transcendence and oneself never ceases. And it is a dialogue which is free of all limiting words and limiting concepts. There are no concepts here. There are no words here. There is only the perpetual act of complete union with the transcendent reality. That is the fundamental, ultimate meaning of prayer, of meditation, of samadhi. Use whichever word you like. It is to be in that state. Now, how can I be in that state if I am impure to start with it anyway? So you see the basic moral purity which is required. Way back in the Rig Veda, which is the oldest religious document of our whole Indo-European race and civilization. It is the oldest document. Way back there, the Lord of morality, the Lord of virtue, Varuna, is the king of the gods. It's very significant, is it not? So now, this business of prayer, it is not just a system of words. The words are like signposts on the way, if you like. That is all. And the way is your own living being, and the way is the transcendent itself. So where shall you or I turn and not find transcendence if we have our eyes open? But if we are self-oriented and self-concerned, we may gabble away prayers by the dozen, but there is no transcendence visible to the gabbler. There is no unity. But supposing one were to use the words of prayer or any ritual system, meditative system. Take for instance the Buddhist Brahma Viharas, the divine abidings as they are called. How does one go through the whole system? One repeats the words, doesn't one? One holds a thought. But a thought is just a pattern of words. What is that inner life there? That inner reality, that dynamic power, is the thing which is released only if we are totally attentive to the feeling of which underlies the words, the live feeling. It has got to be a living reality, otherwise we merely repeat so many words and then it is gone. It's like just putting on one dress after another and taking it off. But what has happened? You've just put on one dress after another and cast it off. Nothing really vital to your well-being, to your holiness, your wholeness, has happened. But take the words and repeat them very slowly, concentrating your whole attention upon the word and the feel of the word. I remember so well, as a little child at school, and I went first to a church missionary society's ladies' college, kindergarten. There we learned these words, and we went through them somewhat in this fashion: Our Father, which art in heaven, hallowed be thy name, etc., etc. You see? But it meant nothing. It was just... Now, when we grow up, do we change? Or do we do the same thing? I have said my prayers, my conscience is at ease, I can go to bed. But consider, consider this particular prayer, the Lord's Prayer. When the need or urge to pray arises, there will be a need, a spontaneous need and urge, not merely the need produced by the stress of circumstance, but the real need from within, this urge. Because out of the love longing of the heart for the perfect thing, the most worthy thing, the need arises. Then spontaneously say the words very softly and feelingly. Repeat the prayer a few times, quite silently if preferred. Now take the words. We start with Our Father. Whose Father? When we say Our Father, mine to start with. Soon I am sensitively aware that he is also your father. This will happen as a living experience. If you become intensely aware, our father, my father, you become aware after a time, but he's also your father. It's an awareness, not just words, not just a thought, not just a picture. It goes right beyond all human limitations. You and I, therefore, are now becoming close-knit. Not only your father, but my friend's father. Not only my friend's father, but my enemy's father. In worldly life, so-and-so is my friend, so-and-so is my enemy. We all live in this state of absurdity, forgetting that all men are fellow men with one father. The father of us all, therefore, our father. Now, when Jesus taught this prayer, remember, the basic origin of the whole of Judeo-Christian culture and teaching. It's enshrined in what is known as the Kabbalah. The Kabbalah is little known, unfortunately, and what little is known is not very well presented. Nowadays, gradually, it is coming to life. And in the original teaching of the Kabbalah, which antedates the days of Abraham, and it comes from the Euphrates-Tigris region, God was presented in his wholeness as emanating himself in 10 major aspects. First, there was the transcendent Trinity itself, the utterly unknown, the unknowable, transcendent Godhood, the Gottheit of Eckhart. This transcendent Godhood with wisdom and intelligence as the second and third aspects of the unknown, the unknowable. Wisdom was called Abba, the Father. The Father is represented as this transcendent wisdom, and Bina, intelligence, is represented as the mother. In one of the uncanonical writings, it is said that when Jesus came out of the Jordan, out of his baptism, one of the things he said was this phrase, "My mother, the Holy Ghost." Now, Bina, intelligence, is both male and female, although she is called the mother. She is both male and female, positive and negative. And the father, Abba, wisdom, by virtue of sheer presence, stimulates this positive and negative aspect of intelligence, which, coming into play, into activity, produces the whole universe. That is why the universe is called the glory of God. But note very carefully, stimulates the positive and negative in Bina, the mother, by sheer presence, the influence of the divine presence. Here lies the root of the concept of the Immaculate Conception, the teaching of the Immaculate Conception. This is the original teaching. So now, the Father of us all, our Father, the supreme divine wisdom. Now, let the whole being stay still, suffused by this intensely living awareness of this factual unity, this simple real love, which is realizable in contemplative prayer, in deep meditation. When the great mystics have written about the love of God, the love of the Father, they have in the deeps of their consciousness realized something of this state. There are cases in which this has been realized fully and completely. And in this state of realization, that is, making real, when the Father is in me and I am in the Father, the psyche is cleansed of its poisons of anger and hate and fear and envy and jealousy and proud self-esteem. And the mind is at peace, and I see the truth of my human nature and am freed in some measure or other of my isolative self-consciousness. Then the separate I, which stands apart and asserts himself, imposes himself upon the world, is out. You see what a simple prayer can do. Simple prayer. The prayer is simplicity itself, but it touches the heights and depths of all things. That sort of realization can emerge out of a single word, our Father. And if you contemplate, that is, go into deep meditation, into the state of inner union with what the word Father signifies, more profound things emerge. See, we are just two words of a prayer can lead you. But the prayer has to be true prayer. Do it very slowly, very quietly, in the stillness. And don't gabble it. Supposing, to take a worldly analogy, you were to take some of the most wonderful slow movements of the great composers and play them off at speed. See what happens. All its beauty is lost, isn't it? Completely lost. So you need time. And if you move in the right way through time, you will touch eternity. Because you will be standing utterly still, carried on the wings of time. And if you stand utterly still as you are carried on the wings of time, you experience eternity. We talk of eternity, we think about eternity, which is a great mistake. You can't think about matters transcendent. They can only be realized in innermost depth of awareness. These dormant faculties which lie in every one of us, They are dormant, they are asleep in the innermost depths of mind, but they can be brought to life this way. And when you are utterly still, carried on the wings of time, and time is a rhythm, not a hurry, not something where there will be a fall, an accident. Time has no accident to it. It's a wonderful rhythm of life, a living rhythm. And when you are completely still, carried on the wings of time, you experience eternity. You can't define it in words and thoughts. You can say some things about it which can stimulate you, which can stimulate the listener or the reader. But you cannot define eternity. So we have quite a different conception then of worship. Holding worthy. And that which you really hold worthy, to that you give yourself. You cannot help giving yourself. You don't have to make a sacrifice of yourself in the wrong sense of the word sacrifice. That to which you give yourself because it's so natural, so you can't help doing it. It just happens, is filled with the peace and the bliss of transcendence, which passes all understanding. And in that sort of giving, in that sort of unification, you have made sacred that which is given, namely your own whole self. Made sacred, that is the real meaning of sacrifice. Sacrifice is not a loss. It is not a pain. It is the bliss of restoration to the ultimate and fundamental unity from which, out of our ignorance, we have torn ourselves apart. So you see, the living aspect of religion, to live this life. And the living of the life begins in the innermost depth of consciousness. It's one of the curious things about the religious life that you start right here from just where you are, this moment, and simultaneously you also start from the eternal, the absolute, the transcendent. It's a paradox. But that paradox is the great mystery and the marvel of religious living. And if at any time, in the quiet, through self-discipline, the relinquishment of all selfness, you awaken to the significance and the power of this paradox, you will find that the way is no longer being shown you from outside, but it has lit up from within yourself. A little suggestion to make. After coffee, we have a sunny day today, We have lovely surroundings here. Wonderful trees, flowers, and beauty, and the peace and quiet of this place, in contrast with the cacophony of the big cities of the world. Spend the second part of this morning session in just walking out and communing. Commune within yourself the transcendent is embodied in each one of us. And only by our free and willing communing the transcendent comes in and takes charge. The ego is like an ugly dwarf. When the ugly dwarf walks out, the Lord of the universe takes charge. Right in your own living being. Commune with all the signs of transcendence around you. For the trees and the flowers and the sun and the stars and the skies and everything. They are all the signs of the handiwork of transcendence. Your own living body is one of the supreme signs for you as a human being of the handiwork of transcendence. Hold it worthy. If the universe took the trouble to produce this body, to make it, to sustain it, to nurture it, how valuable, how worthy is this body, this living body? Let it become, with your communing, the shrine at which you can worship. So, perhaps along those lines you might like to spend your time quietly. Let the noise of words and the clatter of thoughts and emotions chasing each other cease for a time. Do that after coffee. Would you like to? All right. And since I've mentioned coffee, in the evening, after supper, those who want to make drinks and so on for themselves, there is that little place, that little kitchen by the dining room, where you can make coffee and converse and so on. There is also this other place here, but do bear in mind the golden rule amongst many golden rules, not to impose oneself upon one's situation and surrounding. If you can truly pray, if you can truly meditate, if you are earnest in the real sense about the religious life, remember, as all the religions have taught, God, transcendence, Brahman, any word you like, is always present here. There is the omnipresence. Would I make a clatter of teacups in the presence of the Lord? because the Supreme happens to be with us, around us, through us, in us, everywhere, at all times. But because I am blind, deaf, stupid, I behave in this wrong way, inconsiderately towards the Supreme thing. This is how we human beings spoil life, don't we? I mean, this is quite serious. Let there be quiet, let there be peace, and don't disturb the peace. Especially at night. I have mentioned this on Thursday evening, so it would be very good if we can observe this.